I still think about a lot. It makes me feel a bit nauseous when I think about it as a leader was my first time when I was leading more than a couple of people. Our superstar advisor, quite emotional as a person, and that was one of the things that people loved about her. And I said to her, how are you going? And she said to me, oh, I'm feeling like the wheels are going to fall off. She suffered, you know, some quite serious mental health issues of it.
Mm.
And, you know, like I still really, really, really think about, I never asked the next question to get a shared understanding of like, what do you mean by that? But that spell she went through was way tougher than if her manager just had enough brains to go, what do you mean by that?
Welcome to Checks and Balances, brought to you by Partners Life. I'm Michael Vincent, this is James Blair, and today we're interviewing Steve Yurkovich, CEO of KiwiBank. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Kia ora, good to be here, thanks.
You've got some, in terms of KiwiBank, the team, you've got a little bit to live up to because we had Jared Kerr join us for a couple episodes. And he was great, wasn't he?
He was insightful. I mean, at one point you said that I used to be an economist during that, and I was staring around like, I've never been an economist. Yeah, so I don't know why you said that.
Just a passion for it. We know you're a busy man, so thank you for joining us.
No worries.
I might just start with a really open question. CEO of KiwiBank. Run us through, what is that like?
Well, firstly, it's an awesome privilege. And I think the longer I've been in the job, the more I appreciate the privilege that it is. And when I left where I was working previously and joined KiwiBank, I was super excited. It was my first chance to be a chief exec. I was, you know, like all of the usual things about imposter syndrome, and you're going to get there on the first day and everyone's going to go, what? Why have we employed this guy? And all those sorts of feelings. But I think the big decision I made when I changed was I leaving where I was at, or was I joining something I really wanted to get behind? And, you know, when I spoke to my wife about it and what I wanted to do, she was like, we've been talking about it for days. You clearly have decided you want to go. And so I sort of got in my mind, because I'd had a long time there and had a lot of success and heaps of people I loved and customers I loved. So it was quite a big change. But actually I was like, you know, actually I really want to join this thing. And at the time, the purpose is still as the same as today, which is Kiwi making Kiwi better off. And I thought, oh, you know, that's pretty cool. But I probably at that time kind of thought it was more of a strap line or a visioning.
Yeah.
Mm. And if you look at the banks, they're, you know, the lines change. You know, they're designed by agencies, and that's all good. But actually the founding vision of that place was that Kiwi would be better off if it had its own bank. And the longer I've stayed, I've kind of like, actually, it kind of gets inside you. And it's like, actually, because like I always sound like a reformed smoker or whatever when I talk it like this, but the thing for me is that you always act in the best interests of your owner. Yeah. And if your owner is about maximizing shareholder return, you know, for investors, because it's their money, I mean, it's perfectly legit, right? Mm. And great if you're an investor in them. But actually, our owners are all of New Zealand. And the idea is that we would act in their best interests and we would try and make them better off, which is a bit different for a bank.
Mm.
So actually that's been really cool, and it is a real benefit to know that that's the reason we're around. Mm. We've got to do all the other stuff that you do, you know, got to turn around loans and, you know, look after people's savings and do it in the right way and good customer outcomes and all the things we care about. But actually that privilege is kind of working for a place that's anchored on that idea, having governors and directors that are anchored in that idea as well, because if that's not lined up, then that's really problematic, but they are. And then having people join and say things like, hey, I want to make a difference for Aotearoa, or I love your purpose, or I love you're a B Corp, or I think we can make a difference, or you're trying to grow, because people are very attracted to growth,
mm-hmm.
and we've been consistently growing. So the best bankers are keen to get out and make deals happen like you guys have done. And they can feel stifled sometimes, you know, because appetites change and stuff. So having people that are really keen on growing and making a difference is a cool buzz to be around. And the great thing is, you know, when you've got some momentum, you know, it carries on, and I'm sure it's the same in your business. When you lose it, it feels like you're never going to get it back. And when you got it, it feels like the ball bounces your way.
Yeah. It's been like that for about 3 years, Steve.
Yeah, well,
it's the cold winter.
Hey, you know, it's lucky you didn't know how hard it was going to be when you started, right? And, you know, like that's, you know, I mean, like one of my big reflections over my whole career has been, why haven't I had the guts to go out on my own? So I really admire what you guys are doing and achieving. And people always go, oh, you know, it hasn't worked out too bad for you. And that's absolutely true. But like I've had those stages in my career, and I've got a mate who's been particularly successful on a global level, who's a bit of a, not only a really, really, really great mate of mine and works in the sports industry, so it's brilliant about the things that he's been good enough to bring me to, but like we had the chance to go in business together and I didn't. And I always wonder, you know, why I didn't have the sort of stomach to go and do it. And maybe that's why I'm a banker, because I'm risk averse.
If you do reflect on that, why, I mean, like you said, worked out all right for you, but why do you think you didn't pull the trigger?
Well, actually, my now wife had just fallen pregnant with Georgia, my oldest, and going off to the UK and sort of starting something up from ground zero just probably felt outside my comfort zone, you know. And my wife's super close with her family, and I'm an only child, so we didn't have anyone else to sort of rely on and do things. So there was part of that, and that's a good reason to justify it. Mm. The other part is I was probably a bit spooked about what would happen if it didn't work.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, like my mate Bart, he's like, doesn't think like that at all. He's like, but how good is it when it's going to work?
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be amazing. Yeah. And it's interesting, he rang me from London, and it was in the first days when, this is how old I am, when rugby had first gone professional. And he was working in a bank, and his brother-in-law's mate was a guy, Kevin Napier, who was a prop for the Crusaders at the time. And rugby had just gone professional, and he got this contract, and he took it to a football agent. And the football agent was going to take 30% and had no legal background or whatever. He was just going to take 30% and that was it. And it's like, oh, that seems a bit rich. So he rang Taboy Matson, who's Bart's brother-in-law. And he goes, oh, you should speak to my mate Bart. He's a lawyer, and we've both been sports lawyers in a previous, you know, straight out of law school. And he looked at it, and it was like 2 pages long. And he was like, mate, this is rubbish. Like, what sort of contract is that? And I'd done some work for Super League at the time. So, you know, used to quite, you know, detail contracts and stuff. And he said, oh, look, I'll do it for, you know, half the price. And did a proper contract and introduced him to wealth managers like you did a really good deal of structuring the tax and everything. And then, Napier went back to his teammates and said, how good is this? It's half the price and 10 times better. And they were like, oh, hold on, give me that guy's number.
Yeah.
And then Bart was like, oh, I've got like 50 clients in like a few weeks.
Yeah.
He's going to come over, mate, to get amongst that. And I was like, don't know if it's going to last. And
Funny from something just starting as, this is trash, I'll do better for half the cost. So you think about how many Kiwi businesses have started, or there's been innovation from going, we can do this way better.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess you'd call it, you know, growth mindset or above the line or whatever you would call it now. But, like, really, really struck me right through university. He was, like, super entrepreneurial, you know, would start something up. He ran a couple of balls at Otago. One was a total disaster and cost him a lot of money. The second one was a rip of success.
Yeah.
And it's kind of classic, right? Yeah. He's sort of like, he wasn't at all worried about going again after the first one was an absolute failure.
Learned the lessons.
Yeah, well, it was an all-you-can-drink ball, which didn't go too well at Otago. The booze consumption sort of blew out the profits. So,
Declares bankruptcy and moved on.
So next time around, he did a deal, back-to-back deal with the breweries, and he was away. But it is that sort of spirit, which I think is probably the thing I look back on and go, you know, some people are wired for it.
Yeah.
And some people see no as one more step to yes. And great.
Yeah. You mentioned the difference between working between for a Kiwi bank and an Australian owned bank. I'm feeling, you know, every 6 months banks pop up, and you know there's a little bit of outrage. And in terms of brands in the market, like you think about New Zealand, right? There's a lot of positive goodwill for Kiwi Bank to go like, let's go get them.
Yep.
What does, and you mentioned Kiwi Bank is growing and growing. What does Kiwi Bank need to do to really go after and take market share and, I guess, make it more attractive for more Kiwis to make that switch to support locally owned?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, there's also quite a lot in it. So maybe if I roll back to when we started, so 23 years ago, Jim Anderson decides that Kiwi Bank's a good idea. The story is that he was so determined to get it that and kept coming to every cabinet meeting saying, you know, Kiwi Bank, Kiwi Bank, Kiwi. The Prime Minister at the time said, oh, for God's sake, just give him a bank.
just get
rid of him, you know. Yeah. And when you look back amongst those clippings, you know, there's a wall in Wellington, and it's all of the newsprints of when Kiwi Bank was launched, and, you know, big names at the time like Bill English saying it'll never make a dollar, and, you know, it's foolhardy and et cetera, but that sort of central idea that we would be better off if we had our own bank has been true for 23 years.
Mm.
And, you know, when it started, it was sort of a scrappy startup and, you know, look, it was price-led and it was really niggly and you know, some people like that. And, you know, to be fair, like when it started, it had 120,000-odd people on the waiting list for it to open, which is pretty unreal. You know? And then over time, it sort of, you know, people's desire and the way they were banking changed, obviously. And, you know, the idea of going down to the branch and making a deposit, and you could only do that between 4 and 9, 5 days a week, became yesterday's news. And during that time, the kind of the needs of customers became, well, we need a much better app, or online banking first and then an app. So the needs sort of all sort of converged, and I think KiwiBank got a bit squeezed on that. And some of the things that people perceived about us in the past, which the number one reason that people wouldn't come to us when I first started and we did the research, was KiwiBank doesn't have the expertise that I need. And when you said, and I'm sure it's the same as your clients, but when you say to people, what do you mean by expertise? They were like, home loan, credit cards, savings account, insurance, general insurance, KiwiSaver, managed funds. Yep, we do all those.
Yeah.
And because by definition, most people's needs are the same.
Mm.
So we could do them. But I the one thing I really believe about financial services, if you believe it's true, it's true.
Mm.
And if you think about SVB and others, you know, that have collapsed, it's if you lose confidence and reputation, no bank's big enough to survive that. But in our situation, it was, okay, how do we get across the expertise that we do have? Because our existing customers said, hey, we love you. You're doing a great job. You know, you really look after us and you're more interested than some others. And look, I think most customers say that about their own bank because they don't know any different.
Mm.
Like if you ask people who's got the best app, you'll just say, oh, the app that I use, because that's the one you're used to. You've never like tried the others. But anyway, long story short, we were like, okay, we've got to tackle this expertise thing. One of the things that was obvious was as our business model got different, became more different from New Zealand Post, who are all about physical and delivery, and ours was about digital and experience, it was time for us to go our own ways.
Mm.
And one of the reasons people said they perceived we lacked expertise is you go into a post shop and you're doing road user charges, paying the bill, sending your biscuits to old Mr. Yurkovich in the UK, you know, all that stuff. Oh, and by the way, can I get a home loan? And can you talk to me about life insurance, you know, when there's 20 people in the queue?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, no, I don't really want to do that. So going into our own financial services only stores definitely helped. The brand, when we moved to This Is Kiwi, had a massive uplift in expertise, which is, you know, when you ask people to draw a picture of what KiwiBank was, they drew a budget airline. And, you know, that was a bit uncomfortable to face into, but it's the, you know, it's the reality. And so we got into that. And then there's been some things where we've just needed to take sand out of the gears where, because up until a couple of weeks ago, we didn't have Apple Pay and Google Pay. We had Apple Pay pre-Christmas, but just got Google Pay, which is a lot later than others. But the reason we had to do that was the infrastructure we were running on couldn't do that for the type of demand we thought we were going to get. So we had a couple of 100,000 people in Apple Pay in a couple of weeks. Our old infrastructure couldn't handle that. So those really uncomfortable choices around what order are we going to do these things in? How do we not lose our nerve? How do we stick to the things that really make a difference for customer? You know, like reliability, availability, offer, simple and easy to understand, accessible, those things which are not complicated strategy, but sticking to it has made a big difference. And actually, really interestingly, we just launched the Google Pay, as I said last week, but we've already seen the lift in expertise measure.
Mm.
So things like, I don't believe you got the expertise because you didn't have Apple Pay, were things that were in our way.
Mm. Yeah.
So once we've taken those sorts of things away, people have gone, you know what, actually, I don't know why I'm not coming.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Apple Pay is a classic example because we've got the market-leading offering for AirPoints, and it's a tap-and-go card. So, you know, your convenience factor was you just tapped your card. Didn't make a big difference, but people's perception was, oh, phone's way easier. I don't want to have to bring a wallet with me or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And so we needed to get that sort of stuff out of the way and do a better job on brand, and then that would allow our purpose to really shine. And then we need to be good enough that you actually think, you know what, I can be bothered making a change.
Mm.
And if we can, you know, be in front of people like you and have an offer that's, you know, clear appetite, good turnaround, then you look at it and go, hey, you know, have you thought about KiwiBank? And the customer like, oh, yeah, actually, no, not really, but yeah, I will. Mm. So we're sort of trading on the trust that, you know, people like you guys and your business generate, but also just sort of making sure that customers don't have a good reason not to choose us.
Yeah.
And I think that's when we're at our best, because if we can be really successful over the next 5 years and grow to say, you know, from 8% market share to say 15%, for instance, then we'll get reaction from the big banks, because then they're like, actually, this is a bit painful. We're losing share. We're losing profit. We're going to have to react. And I think when that happens, prices come down and New Zealanders are better off. And so that's what we want to do.
Yeah. Michael has been chirping a lot about why interest rates haven't been coming down for the last couple of months.
Well, I guess with anything, we obviously watch the wholesale rates bounce around in the background, and obviously there's different funding mixtures in there and costs associated with changing rates all the time. But we kind of overall, what it looks like to the general public in New Zealand is probably just a lack of competition, right? Yeah. They just see four big Australian banks who are like, sorry, you know, good luck.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that was at the heart of the Commerce Commission market study, which we'll get, you know, as we talk, that'll be out next Wednesday. So it'll be interesting to see what that's got to say. I think, and this is a bit controversial for the industry, I guess, but I think that there's a gap between what the public commentary is from the banks and what people think and see and believe.
Mm.
And that gap has meant that even when there is funding headwinds, even when market rates rally and things, I think the court of public opinion goes, well, you guys have always got a reason why they're not coming down.
You know,
lending rates go up fast and saving rates come down slow and, you know, go up slowly. So, you know, look, I think we could do a better job of explaining and getting through it. But also, like, our view is the best thing we can do is not worry about a Commerce Commission is to do a better job of winning share, and that'll get the response. And, you know, I've been around banking long enough to people, you know, would say when KiwiBank changed the price, they would go, oh, don't worry about it, it's just KiwiBank.
Yeah.
But pre-Christmas, we won 10% share or nearly 11% share of the registrations.
Mm.
Banks are looking at that. That's sort of half the share of a Westpac.
Yeah.
People are starting to think, oh, actually, maybe we can't just leave them to just keep on growing.
Yeah.
So, ultimately, you know, we want to make a more valuable asset for New Zealand, but I think the best thing we can do is try and change the behaviour of those big four.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's easier said than done because they're, you know, bloody well run and they're big and they're organised well and they're competitive. And so, yeah, you know,
that point around taking more market share and then they react. So are you saying that once you hit a certain level of scale, say 15% market share, that's when they have to be more competitive on the pricing front? Is that what?
Yeah, well, in a way, I mean, I think that's the sort of scale that they will always be thinking about. We need to be thinking about you more. Yep. But, you know, on a day-to-day basis now, we know that when we're in front of a broker, they're reacting to our offer.
Mm.
Like, historically, they used to go, oh, don't worry about it, the customer's not going to go to KiwiBank. But when 1 in 10 do, which, you know, if you work out the maths, 1 in 4 of that 10 is their customer, and they lose it, and they go, who'd we lose it to? And they go, KiwiBank. And they're like, oh. Actually, I don't like that. We better do something about that. Mm. So, look, I think we're having an impact now. The challenge we've got is, like, we can always have more of an impact. We want to do more. So, it's, you know, I'm thrilled we've had, since I've been in the job, not to do with me, but, you know, that period I know best, we've had 10 half years, all but two of them have been records.
Yep.
So, we've showed some pretty good consistent momentum. But, you know, even with a record profit, we're a small number compared to those big banks. So, there's plenty of room for us to grow.
Yep. And I know you'll have to answer this question in a particular way,
sure,
but the calls around like KiwiBank becoming potentially like a publicly listed company, more like in terms of the from a public demand going, it'd be cool to have that kind of company to support, because that's the other thing in terms of the NZX. Like, you look, a lot of companies list on the ASX. There's a feeling a little bit around New Zealand in terms of a lot of people jumping to Australia. New Zealand's maybe not as innovative as. Do you think, what do you think?
Where are you from again, James?
Yeah. Well, we were talking about the cricket just before this.
Yeah, that's right.
Whatever way you can answer that question, what are your thoughts?
So, look, I think the first thing you'd say is that model of mixed ownership exists and people can see it operating in Air New Zealand and the energy company. So it's not new. The second thing I'd say is we've got a government that's been signalling in recent times that all options are on the table. So that's just out in the public domain. We personally have not been told anything's going to change for us. And ultimately, that's sort of above my pay grade. That would be happening at our group holding level if there was that sort of conversation. But the idea that it'd be better if there was more capital markets activity, it'd be great to see a bank locally listed. I'd love to invest in it and own it directly rather than as a taxpayer. All those things are ideas that people have been bouncing around for a long time. They could be part of our future, but ultimately at the moment, you know, we're well capitalised. We've got the support from the money from Kiwi Wealth sale that allows us, you know, to put fuel in the tank and we can get after it. And you can spend a lot of time thinking about those things, but they're quite distracting. And I just say to the team, let's try and win every single day. And if that happens, great. If it doesn't, you know, we'll just keep moving forward. Yep. We've been lucky our owners have supported us, whether it be the previous government or the new government. Let's just get after that. But I've been in Aussie for the last couple of days on roadshows around the debt market for just, you know, raising in the funding plan. And, you know, what you do really notice is just how much more activity there is in Australia. Mm. And there's absolutely no argument about that. And if you're you want to make a career in debt or equity capital markets, you know, New Zealand versus Australia, man, there's a massive gap. And, you know, there's also this sort of sense that even today when I did the all teams call, when I talked about being on the road show, there was a lot of, oh, why are you going to Australia? Why don't you focus on New Zealand? The answer is because the debt markets are really small and we need to keep our options open. Doesn't mean that we're distracted by Australia. It's just, hey, we don't need to, you know, we don't need to limit ourselves.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, you know, there's obviously zero when it listed and went to Australia and those sorts of things. Can understand why people want more activity.
Mm.
Yeah. I wish there was, you know, I mean, my number one thing I wish was compulsory KiwiSaver.
Yeah.
Like, that's just driven so much activity on Australia. And, you know, when we're out there talking to people, you know, we're not the most exciting credit in the world. We're a sort of vanilla retail bank who's had a good performance, sort of thing fixed income investors like. They were like, well, how come you don't have compulsory KiwiSaver? Because if you did, then the money would flow into the system, the money would have to be put to work, and then it would drive innovation or offerings, right?
You have
to find a place for the money.
The superannuation set up in Australia is light years ahead of New Zealand just in terms of the way it operates, how they do it, and it's so much better. You can see it throughout the economy as well.
Yeah, and it gets people interested. You know, like, I just think people, you know, if you've got 100 grand or 200 grand tied up in your superannuation, you're pretty interested about how your provider's going, where is it going,
what are the fees?
What are the fees? What are you investing in? What's the ESG model?
Mm.
You know, hey, what's your philosophy? All those things, you know, are much more interesting.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, in terms of even where KiwiSaver is right now, like, financial literacy in New Zealand has jumped a little bit because KiwiSaver balances are big enough where people look at it. And then maybe, you know, the rise of Sharesies and Kernels and Hatch and these direct investment platforms, opposed to property being like quite a lazy asset class, getting more people to invest into the markets. And then you're right, kind of what can spur off the back of it.
Yeah, and momentum, again, momentum feeds momentum, right? So, you know, if you're putting $1 and 10 away in that space, you're kind of interested where it's going and what it's doing for you. So, yeah, I think there's a big opportunity, and it's a shame. There doesn't seem to be a political will to really get into that conversation.
We had David Seymour on the podcast, and I pushed him quite hard on it, and he was not having it. He was all about choice, pretty much.
Right.
So we'll stop barking up that tree. But I couldn't agree more. Apart from, obviously, you know, this podcast is all about people improving their own personal finances. A big thing is, at what point in life does it go, oh, shit, maybe I should stop spending every dollar and plan a little bit for the future? And compulsory KiwiSaver contributions, whether it's for their first home deposit or planning for the future, it's giving them a little bit of momentum before they start, right?
Yeah, and that sort of central idea around money for me has always been, if you pay yourself first, you know, like, I've never been a particularly good saver, but paying yourself first and that money disappearing before you make a decision, it suits my personality. You know, if I was to pay myself last about what's going into managed funds, I'm not sure how much there would have been there from time to time.
Yep.
But taking the maximum contribution and knowing that it's gone and you're dealing with what's left is,
yeah,
you know, you just sort of work out your own personality and how it works. And once it's gone,
I'm working on Mike. He's a work in progress.
Why? But it is really interesting, right? The way that people manage their money. You can give them the math up front and it can be correct math, but some people just can't stick to that, right? Yeah, they have to do it in a certain way, which kind of suits how they manage their money.
Yeah, it probably leads to a good question, obviously. So we've been having some really hard conversations for a while now with clients in terms of, you know, interest rates tripling, people planning their life off 2% interest rates, people going through redundancies, a whole range of different things. How are KiwiBank's clients holding up from what you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly in the last little while, there's, you know, the stresses have been picking up. And by stresses, I mean the sort of bank-defined stresses of 30 days past due, 90 days past due. And in terms of, you know, for the viewers and listeners, when you're 30 days past making the commitment, you should have been able to pay. So I think the stress in the more general sense around it's harder going has been around for quite a while. Mm. We've got about 20% of our customers still coming off those low fixed rates. So 80% have been through. We rang 7,400 people in the last couple of months that were showing signs of stress and saying, hey, look, do you want to talk? Do you want to think through your options? A lot of those people say, hey, thanks very much, but I think we're going to be okay. We're adjusting. And I'll come back to that in a second. Others were like, you know, the same reasons you've raised, which is, you know, downturn. And the usual things we used to get told there were illness, divorce, loss of job, you know, very full employment. And it's still, you know, very, very difficult for those that do lose their employment, of course, but pretty full employment. And obviously illnesses and divorces will continue to happen, but 600% increase around cost of living is the reason I'm suffering. So, you know, 600% is a big number.
Mm.
And when you talk to some of our customers, but also, you know, mates that are in business, couple of them that run hospitality and tourism businesses, the disappearing group of customers has been that 30 to 45 that have got borrowing, maybe kids, and are now facing rates that are in the sixes that were in the twos.
Mm.
And they have just dried up. They're not spending money on going out. They're not spending money on going to stay somewhere. You know, and each of those businesses, you know, we our card spend is down about 15%.
Yeah.
Mm. In hospo and retail and entertainment. Like that 15% is the difference between whether you make money as a small business or you don't, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an owner at the end of that. There's a family at the end of that. There's bills to be paid at the end of that. So those sort of stresses are building up. So I'd say they're, you know, they're manageable at the moment. We did some research not that long ago and we asked people what financial security meant to them. And the overwhelming answer was a roof over my head. So I think, you know, things like streaming services, going out, you know, durables like TVs and things like that, I think they'll see a big drop off in those where people just say, you know what, I'm not going to spend my money on that.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, as you guys appreciate, the test rate when it was 2.5% was 6.85%.
Mm.
But for me, the way I describe it is an imagined problem versus a real problem. And when we're doing it at 6.85, people are saying, oh, it's a waste of time. Why are you testing me at that rate? Yeah. It's too conservative.
I was one of those people.
Rates that's right. Rates are never going to be that high. And, and you know, look, hey, we'll all have our own views there. But actually what happened is now people are actually having to live at that rate.
Yeah.
And so the people that said to you, oh, look, I'll cut back on this and I'll do this and I'll do that, which was kind of theoretical, a bit like I'm going to put more into KiwiSaver or whatever, suddenly that's real, right? And they're living it every single day. And if you're in a household and, you know, $500-$600 a fortnight's disappeared from your disposable, it's really real and you're going to see that change, you know. And what we see is a lot of people, it takes two payments to really feel what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, wow, we're going to have to make some changes here.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how long that'll be around for. What I would say if there's a sort of a good end to it is people are going shorter on rates. So like much more, I mean, you'll see it, but much more popular to be 12 months, 18 months now rather than 2 and 3 years.
Mm.
So a bit like Aussie, maybe the lower rates will pass through faster because they'll be coming off fixed sooner. But, you know, if you fix today on that, you won't be, you know, seeing the benefits until March 25,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And, then probably kinda first payment monthly April 25.
Yeah.
So, you know, relief may be coming.
But she's a long way off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a kind of new normal for a while, which is really hard.
Yeah. Mm. What do you think the next, like, 6 to 12 months are for all those people listening and going, you know, at what point am I going to get a little bit of relief, Steve? What are your thoughts?
Well, Jared's view, and I really, you know, you've had JK in here, and I think he's been remarkably accurate, but also, you know, he doesn't try and grab a headline, which is, you know, one of the things I really love about him as a colleague. He just plays it as he sees it, and he's totally independent, but I like his views in terms of they're well thought through and he knows the impact of them. You know, our call is for cuts. Mm. What I don't know really for me is, and we've been talking about in the last couple of days, is if things are slowing as fast as we think they are, then maybe the first cut is 50. Mm. It's been very hard to predict what the Reserve Bank have been doing, but the logical order sort of seems 25 down.
Mm.
And then, you know, if you do 225s, you get to November and there's not another one until March. So it's a long time to leave it where it is. So maybe if you're getting into November and you can't go to March, you might go more. I don't know. There's so much water to go under the bridge. I feel like it's really delicately poised, but there was no way in my mind when we saw that recent call, you know, from one bank to go up by 50, it's like, no way.
Yeah.
Just cannot see that.
Because I guess, you know, the public sees quite a big lag in the data of what's happening while you guys are, you know, seeing like live spending numbers and see, I mean, you're mentioning, you know, transactions being down and the like. So when are your thoughts on when rates will start to come down?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're grinding down now, right?
Mm.
But I think, you know, it's still a long way above that target band. So you've got to have some sympathy for the Reserve Bank about being tasked with getting it down.
Zero sympathy, Steve. Nobody, everyone's thinking about
the fact. He's, at the end of the day, he's got a clear mandate of what he's got to do.
I got a job.
Because you've got to, if he doesn't, if he starts easing off early, the next time they have to do it, he won't get the same reaction from the market. Like, last time you guys said you're going to do this and eased off early.
Yeah, that's right. And we've got 120,000 new Zealanders turning up, you know. It's not. And, you know, and we're terrible at building houses and infrastructure. Mm. So actually, you know, that's going to hold up rentals and those sorts of things. So, you know, there's some sticky stuff going on.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's definitely tough at the moment.
Yeah, but we know your position, James.
I just want to go out for dinner, Steve.
It's just once, yeah. It is really interesting when we're talking to customers. Because we started working with Kiwi Bank a few months ago, and I found it really interesting when we presented them as an option, how many New Zealanders were like, actually, you know what? The fact that it's a New Zealand-owned bank makes a real difference, like a material difference to the decision that I make.
Yeah.
In terms of your kind of brand out there in the market and the way you approach that, obviously you've got a lot of good equity because you are kind of Kiwi-owned, but record profits for the last 10 years or however long.
Yeah.
What's next on your agenda to make sure you keep growing at that rate?
Before we move on, we talk all the time about planning and growing our wealth, but protecting that wealth is just as important. That's why having the right insurance in place can help when life goes unexpectedly.
And that's why this episode is brought to you by Partners Life, a New Zealand-operated award-winning insurance provider with over 300,000 Kiwis insured and 89% of claims paid.
Partners Life understand that having some insurance is better than having no insurance. They have flexible and personalized solutions for any budget or situation.
Check out their website in our show notes below.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to just keep winning that battle about expertise and perception.
Mm.
There's a long way to go before our profits are anything like the Australian competitors, but also remembering that every dollar of that is a New Zealander's dollar.
Yeah.
It's their own asset. You know, we're not paying it away to anyone. They own something that's worth more. So that's a kind of conversation that people like. I'm sure when you get the other four CEOs in to chat to you, they'll say something different. But what we see in the market is, yellow one, red one, blue one, all same.
Mm.
What's my other option? Okay, New Zealand Bank. Okay, then you're in a sort of, depending on if you live in Taranaki or Southland maybe or whatever, or a member bank, you've got a different set of options that you want to think about. I'm not trying to be disrespectful to that, but if you're thinking about the bigger banks, you sort of go, there's that, they are the same, which is a bit unfair, but the way that people see it, and then there's a New Zealand one. So we just need to keep reinforcing, what does that mean when we, that idea of the campaign, this is Kiwi. You're going to see, I'm not supposed to say this, but I'll just say it anyway.
Just say
it. Is that there's the new lot of the material that we'll be bringing into the public is really focused on trying to do more of a job of articulating what this is Kiwi means and bring home that idea of what we want it to be. And if I think about missteps that I've been involved in the business, we went through a while where we started advertising, come to us because we're not Australian. And actually, in retrospect, It was pretty dumb from my way of thinking, which is, that idea that someone would join something because it wasn't something else is not that powerful. Like all of us buy things, but we don't normally buy them because they're not something else.
Yeah.
We buy them for what they stand for.
Mm.
So it wasn't a huge misstep, but it actually, as I talked about that sort of upward spiral of understanding what this is Kiwi, what Kiwi making Kiwi better offers and what we want Kiwi Bank to be, sort of brought home to me, which is actually the great brands don't go, I'm not X, so buy me. They go, buy me. And then,
I'm
us and this is what we stand for and this is what we do. That's the next step is to get across that, which is, hey, if you're thinking about it and you're thinking about that idea, why wouldn't you come?
Yeah.
Yeah. And to kind of just change things a little bit, the role of banking going forward, obviously things are changing a lot. I was down in Dunedin, got taught to be a teller at Guardy's branch. And on my first day, Steve, they were like, turn the key this way, and I broke the safe. And anyway, branches are closed a lot more these days.
Sounds like your CSO career was about as successful as mine.
Yeah.
Mine wasn't much better, to be honest.
Right. Yeah. Balance every once in a while, but not that often. They tried to close the branch, and then all the pensioners kind of got up in arms, and they kept it open until they closed it later. But obviously banking is changing, right? You've got clients' demands looking different. What do in your branch hours are getting shorter and shorter? What is the future of banking look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think there's a few things that have happened. In terms of branches, we operate a model now which we call One Flexible Team. So, I'll just use Te Awamutu as an example. So in Cambridge, they're open 3 days a week. The team are hubbing with the Hamilton branches. So you, as a team member, you can move around and you might work out at the base one day or in Cambridge and other things if you want to. But the other 2 days we're open, but we're sort of extended as a virtual contact center, if you like. So they're doing, you know, they're doing good customer outcomes calls, they're doing TD rollover calls, they're following up on home loans, they're writing home loans. And when you go around and see these teams, they love it because rather than, like, you know, me standing at that teller waiting for people to come in the door and, as you say, balancing, you know, roughly once a fortnight.
Remember the traveller's checks and putting them up to the light?
Right. Yeah. That's right. So that sort of, you know, inbound, I'll just work with whatever's in front of me has changed, right? And so when you talk to team members is, well, I still love, you know, being part of the community and talking to people. And, you know, we'll have people who come in with, you know, neurodiverse needs that find online hard, or maybe they're helping their kids or whatever they're doing. There's still really great conversations having in the branch. But also they can be on the phone and ringing someone in Kaitaia or Invercargill and helping them as well from their local area. It also means their career can pick up on other jobs and do things. And the cost of being in Cambridge or Te Awamutu property-wise is really low, you know, compared to being in the central city or whatever those things. So we can stay local and we can do good work and people can grow. So the branch shape of what it's doing, and, you know, and same, all the banks are doing the same, I think. Kind of, I reckon we're at a weird moment because I always used to think, particularly if you're using mobile devices, you know, the card was sort of stuffed in the back of that wallet and you never would see it. You know, like when you were buying Apple App Store and all that sort of stuff, you're sort of invisible. I sort of think that with Google Pay and Apple Pay, you know, the card's sort of coming back and being a bit more visible. So your connection with the bank is maybe coming back a little bit on that space. But there's obviously a lot of commentary in Aussie around, you know, how much Apple are cutting everyone's lunch and how much it costs and all those things. So it'd be interesting to see that unfolds. But, you know, in a lot of ways, we're kind of an online retailer. 98% of the transactions we do are online via app and online banking. But for the moments that matter, and, you know, I'll share one with you. I was on the West Coast and I was lucky enough to go down to the branch and they're just closing at 2 o'clock that day and they brought out the white bait sandwiches and it was magic. So good.
Great timing for
you. Yeah, perfect. And there was a mum standing at the door and she had a son with her. And we'd closed, but, you know, one of the team looked out and saw her. And, you know, the thing that I loved about it was the boss was there, the rules were the door was closed, but this person clearly needed some help. So they opened the door. And the son had a particular set of needs, but unfortunately for him, he had lost his debit card for, like, the fifth time. And his only financial freedom is that card.
Yeah.
Because of the situation he's in. And mum had taken some time off work to bring him down to the branch to get the card reissued and it struck a time where we were closed, you know, and by the rules, we'd have kept the door closed and said, hey, come back whenever. Thankfully, they opened the doors and helped and supported that customer and waived the fee and got on with life. But, you know, I don't reckon a bot is going to solve that problem.
Yeah.
You know, I don't reckon a bot is going to answer a deceased estate call where I don't know what to do. Not for a long time anyway. And so the moments that matter are still very much face-to-face. So emotional impact-wise, I still think 95% of what we do is face-to-face. And like you do when you sit down with a customer and go, I don't know what to do about my wealth needs. I don't know. Help me navigate this home loan thing. It's all very complicated. It might not be my first language. I've never done it before. All the stuff you guys help with. You know, that emotional impact's really high.
Yeah.
But on a transaction basis, you know, I mean, you guys are ex-bankers, but when's the last time you went to a branch?
Yeah, not for a long time.
So in case there's, maybe if there's a job to be done, but now with tokenization and provisioning virtual cards and all those things, some of the reasons you used to come in just don't exist anymore or there's a much easier way. And, you know, one of the great mentors and one of the great guys I work with at ASB, Ian Park, always used to say self-service is great service. And, you know, you don't ask customers to – I think when you try and force something down their throat so you can only do it this way, they push back.
Yeah.
But if you prefer to do it yourself and it's easy and simple, yeah, of course I would.
Yeah.
Because I'll do it on my own time whenever it suits me and when I'm in my jobs mode, you know. A lot of people pay bills Sunday night, busiest time in internet banking app, right? And it's admin time.
Yeah.
Like I don't want to come down on a Monday morning and find a car park and come and do all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it's changing, but some stuff isn't changing.
Yeah. And speaking of moments that matter, there's been, you know, it's been a pretty kind of up and down wee while for the country over the last 4 years. Talk us through just a bit about, I guess, obviously COVID and managing the bank through COVID and as well the, you know, the impact that the cyclones have had as well.
Yeah, okay. So it's pretty timely actually because the last time we went away to Aussie to do the road show for the debt issue was just before COVID.
Yeah.
And we turned up, the former treasurer and I had turned up and we were going to see all the investment banks like you do. And some of them started cancelling meetings, and then some wouldn't shake your hand because there was this pandemic. Yeah. And we were like, wow, that's pretty interesting. And, you know, it was, oh, no, we're going to cancel a meeting. And we're sort of, oh, this is overkill, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, we got back to New Zealand and the countries just started locking down.
Mm.
And, you know, that speed of change was, you know, I've always kept a video clip of the news on that day because I always felt that my memory would fade of what it was really like when that news came out, and it was like, wow, is this a movie or what's happening? So there was like really interesting lessons in it. You know, like we went from having like 400 people on a VPN where you could work from home to everyone within 2 days or 3 days. And, you know, just like I was part and parcel of all the good reasons why it wasn't safe and what if so-and-so loses their laptop and they've got their password on the screen and all the sort of edge cases that stop this rolling. Oh, about the cost and blah, blah, blah. A lot of people won't come into the office, you know, blah, 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 blah. And all that just got wiped away, right, because the constraint was you cannot come in and people still need banking. So what are you going to do? So all of those sorts of things where we rolled out, you know, virtual access at home, we got gear to people at home, we just changed our whole mindset because we had to, is a really interesting, you know, example, right? Mm. Because do you need a crisis to do that? Did we need a crisis to roll out remote access? Did we need a crisis to be more flexible about the working environment? You know, people are already, you know, like a lot of the circumstances that people work in now are, I think I would be better if I could be a bit more flexible. You know, there's things going on in my life that means if I could be a bit more flexible, I'd be more productive.
Yeah.
There are some constraints around the way that my life works or how much I have to travel. You know, if I'm coming from north of Whangaparā into the city and it's an hour and 20 minutes each way, do I really need to do that every day? Yeah, you know, like why am I losing 2.5 hours of my life every day, which adds up to be, you know, 12 or 13 hours plus pay parking, plus paid lunches and a cost of living crisis? Do I need to do that every day?
Mm.
Answer, probably not. But absent the kind of lightning bolt that was COVID, we might still be talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, and be totally flat earth about, no, everyone has to come in. Like that sort of stuff. So there are some lessons in it. You know, that connection, forcing you into how do you connect in a virtual way, sort of really pushed the boat out. And I'm still of the view that you need a mixture. Mm, the hybrid is the best idea because, you know, what was interesting even in Aussie, you know, like most of these offices are 50% full. And we went Monday, Tuesday, and they were like, well, don't come Monday because no one comes in Monday. And then Tuesday in Melbourne was the day after the public holiday. Oh, don't come in Tuesday because it's the day after the public holiday. We hadn't really thought that through, but like those things have become habits now, right? And what I sort of worry about is who do you learn off? How do you sustain the culture and what it really means? You know, I'm a kind of, maybe I'm old fashioned, but you know, like for me, you know, the culture and leadership behaviors and postures and those sorts of things, you've got to see a bit of it face-to-face and experience it to know whether it's real. So, look, I don't think we're all coming back, but, you know, it's changed things. I thought what was really good was the fast action from the government. I think what wasn't so good was how long it lasted. But, you know, it's so easy with retrospect, right? Like no one knew. And, like, even now if you watch some of those series on TV and you see how people were, you know, losing family members and were locked out and all those sorts of things. It was terrifying and terrible. But it felt like it went on a little bit long, particularly in Auckland. And I know Melbourne people feel the same way. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of hangovers for it.
I mean, you mentioned in terms of like the split between working from home and working in the office, there's some quite interesting stats starting to come out as well in terms of Gen Zs and that, you know, at the start of their career, they weren't really getting provided constructive feedback. So they thought, you know, because everybody was going through a tough time and had you start having those feedback conversations, the percentage of if you're not at work a certain number of days of year, it impacts pay rises, it impacts the likelihood of redundancies. Some very interesting, you know, trends on the implications of you know, how you work.
Even as your development, right? You imagine like we started our careers in a branch, in a bank. And I always remember thinking, like, I'm in a desert out here.
Yeah.
You know, you imagine being stuck at home, not being able to actually get into the head office. Like, you'd be the similar vibe. You just need to get where the people are.
You're just in Northcote Point, mate.
I think the, you know, like, I think that the types of roles that have apprenticing, like, you know, I remember some of the, you know, the big lessons in your career are, like, you, the way a leader behaves or doesn't behave, you know, the university of life around, hey, that James is so different to me, but look at the cut through he gets. I never would have imagined that worked that well, you know, but it all becomes part of your toolbox, which is, oh, okay, so some clients are deeply analytical and they just want facts. Others are very emotional and they just want to know about the big picture and why, you know, Kiwi Bank's a great bank because it's B Corp. That's all I need to know, right? I'm coming.
Yeah.
Others are like, you know, show me the history of their rates over the last 10 years. You know, they're both what you have to deal with. And, you know, and sometimes we've had, like, we've gone out and we thought we were going to win business and, you know, we've done terrible and you learn so much out of it, which is, you know, you assume too much, you ask the wrong questions, you all those learnings that you learn off seniors. And then you also look at them sometimes and think, I'm never going to do that.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, and that's, and that forms part of who you are. Mm. And, you know, some of the kind of, you know, moments where the boss says to you, know, I care about you enough to let you know that that wasn't good enough.
Mm.
Or, you know, like you weren't well enough prepared or, like, you know, they hurt, but you learn and you grow from it. And so, look, I don't think it has to all be one way, but, you know, we try and I don't want anyone to come to work because we're telling them to come to work. Like, what I do worry about in our organisation a bit is there's, like, I don't think for bigger organisations is the equity of the flexibility. Like, some roles have a lot more flexibility than others. I think one of the things all organisations are still working through, which is if I am in a branch and it's opening at this time and it's open 7 days a week, my flexibility is pretty, and like the work I do in there might be flexible, but my attendance is not very flexible. Yeah. Whereas we might have people working corporate HQs that can come in 1 day a fortnight.
Mm.
You know, and that's maybe right, but if I look around the organisation, I think to myself, oh, okay, I come in, you know, I work Saturdays and Sundays, my busiest days at, you know, St. Luke's or wherever, Henderson Mall, and you guys can come and go, is that right? Mm. So, you know, there's a lot of settling to do over organisations around it and finding out what the right balance is, but I don't think anyone's got it perfectly right, and we talk to a lot of people globally about it. You know, you see some of the Aussie banks have been quite firm on getting people back in. Others have gone, in Aussie in particular, in Melbourne. Others like us say, hey, look, the expectation is we'd like to see you in at least 2 days a week and you should organise with your team what works best. And that's been pretty successful so far. Yeah. But I think we have to keep revisiting it.
Are you finding that people come in more than the 2 days a week?
Yeah, a lot of people do.
Humans need humans.
Yeah, a lot of people do, but a lot of people, you know, like there's a lot of people that work in sort of technology engineering and things like that, just love the idea that they can be creative and do the work and get it done, and they sort of wonder why they come in to waste time when they could be doing that.
Mm. Yeah.
Others like me, you know, the definition of living hell is my own company and being at home by myself. I'm like, I've got to come in.
Yeah.
And probably Charlotte, our CPO, and others would say it'd be good if you show that you work from home a bit more. Yeah. But for me, like with people coming in and out, if I, you know, I always feel like I'm going to miss the chance to catch up and try and get the vibe. And so I feel like I shouldn't have to change what I do because of the policy, and I don't expect other people to change because of it either if that's not them at their best.
Yeah.
Mm. You mentioned right at the start, I'm keen to spend a little bit of time talking about you and your learnings.
Sure.
You mentioned a little bit about the imposter syndrome when you moved into this role, which everybody can relate to if you're a grad getting your first role. Mm. How did you overcome that?
I wouldn't declare the case closed. There's certainly times where you still feel that moment, but I think you just got to, you know, you talk with people and you work with them. The more you're prepared to share, that's how I'm feeling, the more people will likely, I think humans are good people generally and they'll share it as well. You're like, hey, I've had that feeling.
Mm.
I think getting people around you that were honest with you and tell you whether they're doing a good job or not helps build confidence overall. And then part of it is like simply like, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway is like I'm trying my best. I don't have to have all the answers. It's not always going to be fantastic. But, you know, if it's well-intended and it's authentic, then you get through it. But I also think just sharing it with people really helps to know that you're not alone in those feelings. And some of those feelings are your instincts around actually, you know, preparation or topic or those things. And they're actually pretty good instincts to have.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, ultimately we're all wired differently, but I think I get more out of myself by being a little bit like that, that I actually try a little bit harder.
Yeah.
But can be tiring. And you kind of got to be a bit more friendly to yourself sometimes, you know, like that inner critic. Like, you know, I often think, like, no one would be mates with your inner critic. They would think, what a dick. Like, yeah. You'd never get off my back. You're always criticizing me.
Yeah.
Like, if that was your friend, you'd go, you know what, I think I need a new friend.
Yeah.
You've seen the external James. You should see the internal
James.
Yeah, geez, mate. Yeah. So I do think there's a bit of that, right, which is
actually,
am I being kind to myself? Am I giving myself a break? And we've worked with some people and they've got a great saying, which is, you know, I care about you enough to let you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the internal critic, if that was that person, like a good friend would say to you, look, mate, I think, you know, this is not you at your best. Maybe you should do so-and-so or try something different that's not working. Hey, that's great. And like in the workplace, if you can take it professionally, not personally, when you get good feedback, it's hard sometimes. But, like, you know, like in the sporting sense, you're always debriefing what your performance was like and that's how you get better.
Yep.
Like, why wouldn't you be doing that in the workplace? But it's got to be done professionally and it's got to be done, you know, from a good place.
Mm.
Like, because otherwise, you know, that's not much fun.
Don't be a dick.
Yeah, it's a good rule, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, some of us try to live that. And what about
that's you being one.
Passive aggressive. I mean, my middle
We've
name.
We've been sitting in a planning about this far apart from each other all day. So
that's a long time.
What about the public scrutiny element with the role? How have you learnt to handle that?
Like it's part of the job, right? So I think it'd be weird to take the job and then go, oh, you know, it's really hard. People know who you are or whatever. Like I try and be who I am. That's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. I spent a little bit of the time when I first got into COVID reading people's commentary about what I did online, despite everyone told me not to. And that was not, you know, and now I don't.
Yeah.
But I just try and show up who I am. Like I try and like to believe that I'm, you know, well-intended and I've got the best interests in it. Like my friends know who I am, my family know who I am. I'm not everyone's cup of tea. I don't want to try and be everyone's cup of tea. It's too hard. So, yeah, look, I do the best job I can. Like it's a privilege to be in the role. There's a few times, I mean, I feel the most uncomfortable when a team member's seen you on a Teams call or whatever and they know you well and you turn up in Queenstown and they say hi. I always have this sinking feeling like I'm supposed to know who you are, but I might have met you once, you know, a year and a half ago. That's the bit I don't like. I feel always uncomfortable about that. But in terms of, you know, being in the job, no, it is what it is. It's good.
Yep. I've seen some of the articles that you've been a part of and you've spoken about Kiwis being more comfortable with failure, which I think is quite interesting. What's a time that, can you talk about a time where you've
failed? I've had plenty of those. I've shared one where when I was working in my sort of early first job out of being a lawyer, and I'd become like really interested in what at the time was called entrepreneurship, which was basically innovation hubs within a big organization. And I'd been reading a lot about how, you know, the people with the answers are usually closest to the customer, but they don't often have a way to surface those ideas to get solved. And so had this idea that we were going to do this thing called an innovation lab, which became Dialab, and it was going to be amazing and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so we were having a couple of drinks at one of the all-team updates, and the amazing guy, Hugh Barrett, who's, you know, sadly passed away, but Big Hugh was the CEO, and I sort of cornered him over a sausage roll and a beer saying, oh, I've got this great idea. We should launch this iLab and, you know, generate all this great ideas and everyone's going to have a say and it's going to be fantastic, and I've got this plan. And he said, oh, okay, sounds good. And he, like Hugh was a very decisive guy, and he was like, okay, I'll give you the money. And I was like, oh, okay, and told him how much I needed. And he was like, okay, well done. And there was no other paperwork or whatever. And I was like, oh, okay, right, where are you? I came back and I sat down with my colleagues in the digital area at the time where I was working. And I was like, oh, Hugh's giving me this money. We're going to build a website that's going to collect the ideas. And I told him how much he'd give us, and they're like, you're insane. Like, that is like not even a quarter of what we need. And I was like, oh. And so, you know, there's a classic example of enthusiasm not matching expertise.
Yeah.
And but actually it was the mother of invention, because I managed to convince Russell McVeigh to give some time for free. Our partners at Datacom at the time donated and built the website for free. And we got a couple of other sponsors. So we got across the line on it, but man, it was touch and go. And a lot of people gave up a lot of free time and goodwill to get us there. So it's kind of a classic example of just thinking it through a bit and not getting too ahead of yourself. Like we built out an offering at the time, which was years and years before it happened, but we built out an offering which was online banking on your mobile phone. And this is back in the days, you guys are too young, but it was like Alcatel, and it was, can't even remember what the service we, a WAP,
yeah,
which was wireless application protocol, which was terribly slow. It was like dial up.
And you terribly had, expensive.
Yeah, so, you know, it was massively expensive and you had to burn the SIM card with the account details onto the phone.
Yeah.
And you could do transactions on your phone. And so this was like 10 years before anything else, you know, and it was spurred off this idea that Sir Ralph Norris said at the time, which is, hey, a phone's just a credit card with an antenna. So that sort of idea was like, oh, okay, this is great. And we partnered with some people. And, you know, like it was the precursor to mobile app banking now, but it was like 10 years ahead of its time. Its UI was terrible. It was super expensive and super slow. None of the things that you think of today. But ultimately, the company that we partnered with, MCOM, got bought in America and did an amazing job. And Adam and those guys are real powerhouse of fintech ideas in New Zealand now and great people. Just so sometimes the idea is good, but the mistake is that it's way ahead of its time, way ahead of the demand. Probably on a personal level, the one I still think about a lot and makes me feel a bit nauseous when I think about it as a leader was my first time when I was leading more than a couple of people. And it was in the wealth management business of private portfolio services. And our superstar advisor she was very creative and she was like a gifted chef, quite emotional as a person. And that was one of the things that people loved about her. And I was at work one day and we were busy because markets were quite good. And she was busy and she was great with customers. And I said to her, how are you going? And she said to me, oh, I'm feeling like the wheels are going to fall off. And I walked away from that conversation and I thought, oh, you know, kind of, I just never processed it.
Yeah.
You know? And I think in my own mind at the time, I probably thought, oh, she's just saying that, you know, because she feels a bit wobbly or whatever. But actually, she suffered, you know, some quite serious anxiety and mental health issues of it. And, you know, like I still really, really, really think about if I'd only just said to her, what do you mean by that?
Yeah.
She would have said to me, like, I'm under pressure. There's so many jobs. This is, you know, when you're writing in financial plans and all that sort of stuff, there's so many moving parts. And I never asked the next question to get a shared understanding of, like, what do you mean by that? If I had, you know, I always think, like, she recovered fully and gone on to have an amazing career, but that spell she went through was way tougher than if her manager just had enough brains to go, what do you mean by that? And so that was one of the worst situations, you know, like mistakes and learnings is like if I think about it now, whenever there's been a balls up, it's often anchored in that we didn't have a shared understanding, you know, of what was really going on and the investment to get a shared understanding about, you know, what do you mean by that? Are we on the same page? You know, why have you got this different view? You know, as I've got more experienced, it's like, it's obvious that if I see the world through you guys' eyes, I'd see a different picture, you know, than I see looking at you guys. If, you know, there's more than one truth in the world, like, you know, you guys should expand rapidly or not expand, depending on what the situation is. And it could be, you know, in your planning session, I'm sure there was those colliding perspectives around, let's go hard, let's, no, not now's not the time. Actually, now's the perfect time because other people are going to sit back and not push. Well, should we? Because, you know, what are people going to do and say? And both of those are true if you believe them, right? So those are the sorts of things that I look back on and just think, you know, a bit more time on dialogue, a bit more time on shared understanding of the things that make a big difference. And those are the things I regret the most.
Yeah. Mike's push today to answer your question is like, let's open an office in Greece and Croatia. And I'm like, mate, now's just not the right time.
So. Dobro Dorsley.
Yeah.
Mate, Croatia, hey. Come on.
Yeah, they just got the Euro. What are you
They're
doing?
The great people. Like Hvar or Korčula would be the perfect place.
Yeah. So maybe not the Greece office immediately.
I mean, I'm here for it.
But Mike, you can hope for the future.
Absolutely.
I think the other thing quite interesting that you said, Steve, I mean, quite a few things in there. And thank you for sharing that in terms of, you know, a lot of people, you know, that vulnerability, people like to kind of not show that side. The piece around the innovation lab and like you spoke about, you know, that you'd undercooked the budget, which I always get worried when I'm doing like a calculation I haven't divided by 12 in terms of them. Like, this looks too good. But you were, I mean, part of it was like people are going to stuff things up, right? Yeah. But I mean, granted, you just got a bunch of people to work for free, but yeah, you worked out a solution, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it does. I mean, that constraint forces you to try and think creatively. Like that option to have, you know, a partner like a Russell McVeigh who did a lot of work for the bank, and I'd been a lawyer, so I had an established relationship as an in-house counsel, and come to them and say, hey, look, here's a way to learn about creating new ideas. And they were like, oh, okay, that sounds good. We can do that. We'll be part of it and, you know, might build a stronger relationship because, you know, they were obviously always amongst the big firms we were choosing work. Like that option existed, but before my stuff up, I hadn't even thought about it. It just that was that catalyst of like COVID, like we talked about before, is like, okay, now the situation we're in, how are we going to think about it differently? You know, and like the regrets I've had like that past is kind of that inbuilt thing for me, which is, you know, the continuum of this is really safe and I'll take the choice versus this is safe enough and I'm going. Like we've all got a different feeling for that. But I think New Zealand would be way better off if we had a bit more tolerance for giving it a crack, knowing that you can iterate, knowing that you can change some things. And, you know, if I use words like wheelhouse and pivot, you can stop the film. But, you know, if you think about those ideas and saying, well, actually, maybe this is nearly right, but actually it's been tested in the wild and what would I go from that, or that I tried something. And, you know, like history's so full of people who had so many cracks that weren't quite right till they got the right thing, you know. And whereas, you know, I think about, you know, places like America and others are a lot more tolerant of people going for it, maybe it misses, but actually what you learn, let's have another crack at it. And so I think New Zealand's got this sort of like, you know, it's quite negative vibe to either tall poppy success, oh, you're getting a bit big for your boots, aren't you, talking about how successful you are. It's like, oh, okay. And then, oh, no, don't try anything. Like, what if I fail, you know, like I've, you know, and I always think about it in like in a football sense, you know, you're thinking the penalty shootout. Are you one of the people who wants to be ninth on the list so you hope that it's all over by the time it comes to you? Or are you like, hey, I want to take the first shot?
What a great way to think about it. I love that.
And it's like, you know, do I want to take the first shot?
Yeah, are you the one that's give me the ball?
Because I'm going to make a song. We're going to be one up after I score, right? Or do I want to be, what if I miss? Mm. You know, the keeper looks big. What if I put it over the top? People are only going to remember my miss, right? Yeah. So those are I think that's the mindset where people can help and support you.
Yeah, and the other piece with that kind of analogy, right, is it's not necessarily as black and white as you want the ball or you want to be ninth in the list. Some people are like, well, I want the ball, but I'm also scared to have the ball.
Yeah.
And so that's a normal reaction to have as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, there's a great clip, I don't know if you've seen it online, but Cristiano Ronaldo, and, you know, encouraging his Portuguese mate to take the penalty.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen it on the clip, but it's quite inspirational, you know, like he just, as the captain, he goes over to him and he goes, no, we believe in you. You just do your best, and if you miss, you miss.
Yeah.
You know, but that sort of sense where sometimes you just need someone with a hand on your shoulder to go, you know, you got this. But give it a go. And if you miss, you're the best person to try. Yeah. What will be. Let's get after it, you know. And so that sort of bit of inspiration and a little bit of support and knowing that it's going to be okay if it doesn't work out.
Yeah,
it's getting the bounce back.
It's interesting as well, like you talk about the tall poppy syndrome and Kiwis scared to have the crack and those sort of things. But you kind of backtrack a little bit, and there was that time where we were a rock star economy, we were innovative and kind of punched well above our weight, and a lot of that talk seems to have really disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know what the phenomenon of that is, that we've gone back into our shells a bit. But I mean, you know, like the other thing that I sort of always was sort of struck by was, I don't know if you ever saw that, because I kind of like the idea of sports and how it impacts leadership, but there's a moment in that Richie McCaw documentary where he's walking on the beach and he said that his whole mindset had changed, which is, no, I want the pressure, you know, because they'd feared like that loss the previous time and I was there and it was dreadful. But that idea of, no, I want the pressure, you know, I want to go into that. That's what we work for. You know, that's where I'm going to shine, that sort of mindset. It's, you know, it's a pretty interesting mindset to have, right?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of successful people have that most of the time. I don't think all the time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they also recognize it's not always going to work, and that's okay.
Mm. Well, Steve, I know you're a very busy man, so I'd like to say thank you very much for coming sharing kind of your journey, what's happening at Kiwi Bank. There's a lot to learn. It'll be really good to get you back again soon.
Yeah, love to.
Thank you, everybody who listened. Please make sure to subscribe, give us a review and a like. Big thank you to Partners Life for sponsoring us, and we'll catch you next time.
Cheers.